S back on. We've definitely had some difficulty here doing that. Bear with me, folks. We're trying to get the second hour going here. And I'm calling Frosty Wooldridge. Frosty, welcome to the show.
Yes, Mark, it's a pleasure. Always a pleasure.
Well, I had a little difficulty. I got another Skype update, and they always change things a little bit each time, so it was harder to get a hold of you than normal. And I'm going to try to pull Steven back into. So I had a little dead air. Sorry for the live listeners. There won't be any dead air on the, of course, the recorded version of this, which I'm a little bit more concerned about. I wanted to talk a little bit. I know you got a whole thing prepared, but I wanted to chat just a little bit about the State of the Union message. I don't know. Did you hear any of that at all?
Yes, I did. And, you know, like all State of the Unions, you have all of the emotions wrapped up. I think Trump is a master, having been on TV for quite a few years there with his You're Fired, or whatever that was. And, you know, so he's a master at, you know, showing all of the emotions. And he showed the World War II veterans. He showed, you know, the little child who had cancer and beat the cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to, you know, present quite an extraordinary emotional display of Americana, if you will. And I truly think that we as Americans need more Americana, because as you look at what's happening to Europe, Europeans are losing their ethos. And when you lose your ethos or your culture or your identity as a certain individual from a certain country, then you lose a sense of belonging, you lose a sense of identification with yourself, but also with your country, you know, countrymen and women. And I thought he did a fantastic job doing that. At the same time, you know, look at the fracturing of all of those different representatives there in the House of Representatives, and certainly throughout the Congress. You have I think there was like 80 women who were all dressed in white outfits. And it's funny, because 2 years ago, Melania Trump, who's the first lady, was discharged with all sorts of acrimonious assaults on the fact that she was wearing a white suit at the inauguration, and, you know, up and around that arena. And then all of a sudden, she was wearing black this time, I think, and all these women were wearing white, and yet there was no comments on that white entourage there in the House of Representatives.
So
again, you have the pageantry, and you have the emotions, and you have all the statements by the president, it was you know, just another one of the State of the Union addresses that everybody looked at. I think more people looked at that than watched the Super Bowl, from what I understand.
You know, I counted like 40-something standing ovations.
Mm-hmm.
And that,
yeah.
I would thought that was pretty impressive. But you mentioned the Democrats dressed in white, just like the KKK, right?
Yeah, there was a mention that there was a similarity that all these Democrats were. And I don't know if people know much about that, but, you know, Democrats they did start in the KKK.
I didn't know that.
That was one of. Yeah,
is that true?
So, yeah, I'm pretty sure that you have that history of that. You'd have to look back up, but I'm pretty sure that's where that all came from.
Wow.
So, you know, again, one of the things that's happening to our country, as an observer here, certainly for the last 50 years, since I turned, you know, 22, and that is, the most fractured we were and ever have been were the years of the Vietnam War. We had we had the Detroit riots in 68, and I was, you know, living up in that arena, and I worked in Detroit for 15 years, so I'm very much aware of what happened to Detroit, how and why everything that happened to Detroit happened. I've written about it. And so you've got that fracturing and fragmenting of the racial conflicts, not only in Detroit, but you've got the same thing going on in Miami. You've got the same thing going on in Los Angeles. You've got the same thing going on in San Francisco. You've got the same thing going on in Atlanta. And so you have that kind of a consequence, but you also have the political fragmentation. And even though Trump has been extraordinarily successful on so many different levels, he's called every name in the book. I mean, he's been called a racist, he's been called a xenophobe, he's a nativist, he's a nationalist. And so you really can't win, no matter how successful you are. And I think a lot of it has to do with his acerbic personality. And that's just part of the package. And what do you do with that? I don't know. We all get to choose which way we want to go and who we want to support, and we'll see what happens along that thread.
Don't you think a lot of this fracturing is contrived or staged or stoked by the media, though?
There's no question. If you go back and look at Mark Twain, one of the greatest American writers, and all that he wrote, he said that in this country, one of the worst things that we have to face and suffer from is the slant of the media. And there's actually a special quote by Mark Twain on how the media is, you know, he even says that they can't milk cows and they can't cobble a shoe, but they can write a slant on anything they want, and the public believes it. And so you got a problem, you know. And one of the things that's going on right now is you've got somebody like Elizabeth Warren or even a Bernie Sanders who are promoting socialism, and the harsh reality is socialism does not work. It's never worked. It can't work. It has to come out of a barrel of a gun. And it's funny because I'm looking right now by a quote on Facebook, and it says, Trump is the symptom, capitalism is the disease, socialism is the cure. And I want everyone to understand one thing about socialism. It means that when you go out and you gain an education and you gain the ability to read and write and perform mathematics and science and biology and sociology and zoology and calculus and all that goes with that, you become an intelligent person. And then you are so intelligent that you can be trained to be a doctor. You can be trained to be any kind of a plumber, an electrician. You can become all of hundreds of different jobs, IT worker and so forth. Under socialism, the people who don't do that, the people that are the 44 million Americans that are on food stamps right now, and the millions that are on welfare in Section 8 housing, that's socialism. In other words, they're not contributing. And the problem with socialism is when there's more people that are not contributing, that are riding the gravy train, if you will, and not pulling the gravy train, you then have a collapse of the system. And the example, of course, is Venezuela. That country is an exact, and I've traveled through that area on my bicycle, and I've been all through South America, and so I've seen it up close. And when you have somebody that creates something like a socialism, and then you encourage those who will not participate in the society but only leech off it, if you will, then you have, in the end, ultimately, you have a collapse of that system. And so that's some of the things that are going on right now. And of course, we've got quite a few people in the House. I mean, one of them's named Cortez, some lady from New York. She's a sky in the pie, just you know, pretty girl with almost a vacant brain, and she's, you know, proposing all sorts of socialism as the cure, and then we got to equalize income. But the problem is, there is no way to equalize income, because if you have a person who drops out of high school and can't read and can't write, and then they go to McDonald's so they can punch a button and they can literally be told what kind of change to give back to a customer and to fix a hamburger, that's a redundant job that takes no brain power. Can you give that person $20-$30 an hour? And the answer is no, you can't, because they're just simply not able to perform at the level that would allow them to have a greater financial remuneration. And so the rest of us who are, studied all through high school, I studied my butt off. And then I studied 7 days a week in college, and I'm just a farm boy from Michigan. And the only way I got to be as intelligent and as educated and had gained the breadth and depth that I did is because I worked my tail feathers off, whereas those who didn't, they literally dropped out. And I've gone back to all my high school reunions, all the kids that were smoking and drinking in the parking lot were the ones that became the truck drivers, and they became the three blonde diner, and they become used car salesman, and they became a cashier, and they became all those redundant jobs. And so and those are jobs that we have to have, obviously, but they're not going to get paid equally to the job of a doctor or the job of an IT worker. So that socialism doesn't work in the end.
You know, Frosty, I've been a software engineer for about 25 years now, and this past September, I worked every day in September, 7 days a week. But nothing was harder than school, I thought. You talk about studying. There was nothing harder than the 2 degrees I got. I thought, everyone says, wow, enjoy this time in college because this is where it's really fun, because when you get out, it's going to be harder. I found just the opposite. That when I got out and I got to my job, I was like, hey, I like this. I enjoy this. Yeah, I have to work hard sometimes, but for the most part, this is fun. But school was tough, man. I thought.
You did not have any extra time. You were studying 7 days a week. Yeah, I didn't date until my senior year. I had a couple dates my senior year because I was studying. I would play racquetball 3 times a week for my exercise, and I lifted weight, along with that. But that was to keep my physical ability and express my energy.
And you still had to miss that sometimes, right? Still.
Oh, yeah, because if there was a test coming up, I was never one to pull all-nighters. I was the steady slogging away.
Yeah.
So I would get to class, I would review the notes from yesterday, and then I would stay 5 minutes and review the notes of I just took for that day. And I reviewed on the weekends my entire, notes throughout the whole term. Mm-hmm. And then when the test came, I was ready to go. And of course, I've always said preparation is 9/10 of success. And the ones that don't prepare, and that's the ones that are the socialists, if you will, they're the ones that want to ride the gravy train. They want to live off of what you and I do, and we were the ones who worked our butts off to get where we got.
You know, this Alexandria Cortez, for some reason, thought that she was just, running for a position, but she really is, a senator?
House of Representatives from New York.
I couldn't believe that. When I finally, she's actually in the House of Representatives, because I've heard her speak, and...
Oh, shit. She sounds like a complete lunatic, really. They asked her a question. Well, what do you think about Roe versus Wade? And she says, well, that's how the illegal aliens get across the Rio Grande. Either they row or they wade.
No. She didn't say that. I mean,
but that's the kind of answers that she gives, because she does not have a clue about what she's talking about. It's so funny.
But I think the Democratic Party is starting to work with her and train her and try to make her appear better, because I think she's she may be their golden boy or golden girl or whatever you want to call it.
Well, they can, but at some point she's so vacant. She is so shallow in her understanding. I don't know if you know this or not, but she was asked by Anderson Cooper, what about the three branches of the federal government? And she answered that was the presidency, the House of Representatives, and the United States Senate. That's what she thought were the three houses or the three branches of the federal government. I saw the interview. I mean, you go, what? She's never read the Constitution of the United States. I would bet my life on it. She's never read, or the articles, or the Declaration of Independence, or any of that. She has no clue what she's actually doing up there. She just spouts off whatever's on her mind.
And her whole thing is green everything, which, you know, I'm for green stuff too. But she's like, sure, convert all cars in 10 years, convert every building in 10 years. It's like total bankruptcy. It's trillions of dollars.
As a matter of fact, when she was interviewing with Anderson Cooper, he calculated it out at $39 trillion to do all the things that she wants to do. And so, yeah, what that means is, you know, when you have societies that are monoethnic societies like you had once in Norway, that has everybody has a single ethos, everybody has a national identity, and everybody works. The same thing as Sweden. Well, guess what? All those things are now collapsing in Sweden and Norway because they no longer have a monoethnic society, and they have no longer everybody working. They've got all these immigrants coming in that have no ability to work. They have no education. They have no sense of responsibility whatsoever. And at some point, you're going to see. I'll guarantee that within the next 5 to 10 years, I see a complete collapse of Norway and a complete collapse of Sweden. Into racial conflict, religious conflict, but also financial, degradation. I mean, that's going to happen to them. Well, it's probably going to happen to many other of the Western countries that keep taking in all those immigrants, because there's no way those immigrants can respond to and or contribute to the financial and the building and all of the aspects that make a society run. They can't do it because they don't have the intellectual horsepower to do it or the background to do it. And so those countries are in a lot of trouble. Well, guess what? So are we. We're $22 trillion in debt right now.
Are we?
Yeah, we're $22 trillion in debt. You're seeing 44 million people on food stamps. 44 million. It was a high of 48 during Barack Obama. And so you're seeing all that. Then you're seeing 10, I forget, it's something like 3 to 4 million children. 13 million children are living under the poverty line. And millions, 2 to 4 million are so poverty-stricken they eat free breakfasts and lunch, which we pay for, in the schools across America. And so you've got a big, big problem, and it's right here in the United States of America.
You know, you mentioned something about Europe there, and I was, I think it's Gavin McGinnis that talks about this, and maybe Sam Harris mentioned this too, that in Islam, they often marry their first cousins, and they're having...
Yeah, very much inbreeding. Yeah.
There's a big problem with inbreeding now, isn't there?
Yeah, there's so much inbreeding within the entire Islamic arena that... they are literally breeding themselves down intellectually.
Oh, yeah. This is a big problem, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it really is, because if you get enough inbreeding going on, then you have you will absolutely degrade the intellectual capacity and ability of individuals that continue to have inbred. I mean, that's with horses, cows, pigs, anything else. Well, you know, we're animals too. We're just animals that think, and if you keep inbreeding, you're going to get a degeneration of all sorts of consequences.
And it also makes it more likely that a person will, I've heard, it makes it more likely that a person will be like irrational or prone to anger, or there's certain effects like that inbreeding have. Have you studied that at all?
Well, not with any great, because it's definitely in places where you have tight ethnic groups and there's not much where you can go anywhere, but
like Turkey and maybe Pakistan or another one of these countries.
It's like all the royals and the aristocracy of all the different the thrones and kingdoms down through time, they interbred. Mm-hmm. And as you continue to interbred, that's why you had. I think it was Rasputin tried to cure the bleeding disease, hemophilia.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you inbreed enough, you're going to have the genetic DNA transfer of all of these consequences.
It has makes you more prone to certain diseases too, doesn't it?
That's right, exactly, because you don't have the vibrancy.
Now, you're saying that what you're seeing is that Europe is about to fall. Are we going to see France basically kind of go away or something like that?
Well, I got into a big conversation just two nights ago with a English PhD lady who's English literature, and she was asking me a lot of questions like this. All I can do is give some kind of a projection based on my own understanding. Mm-hmm. And what I have found is that when you have all of this diversity and multiculturalism, you have a loss of identity, you have a loss of community, you have a loss of the ethos. And that's what's happening in Europe right now. I've been to Europe three times now, and my brother Howard's been over there 20 times, and he's watched it for the last 40 years. And right now, I'm reading a book that is almost distressing beyond imagination. For anyone who wants to read it, it's Douglas Murray, The Strange Death of Europe, and it's identity and immigration and Islam. And Europe is killing itself. He flat out says it right there on the back of the cover of the book, that Europe is committing suicide. And it's taking in, again, all of these barbarians from essentially from all of Africa and the Middle East who have done nothing for their own civilizations, and they're starving to death. They're overpopulated. They have no educational propensities whatsoever. In other words, they're all illiterate. And they are streaming and screaming out of Africa and the Middle East, and they're literally bringing all of their illiteracy and their lack of skills and of ability to even function other than eat. Literally eat, and that's about all they can eat, and defecate is about all they can do. And he said they started coming in by 1,000, you know, a week, and then they started coming in by 10,000 a week, and then they started coming in by... And in fact, he goes over the Camp of the Saints, which I've read, which was by Jean Raspail, who wrote this novel back in 1973, and he was French, and he said, and it was a novel predicting that they were going to literally, and they were coming from India, his were coming from India, and I remember he said, you don't know these people of mine, they are the barbarians of the world, and if they ever land on your shores of your country, they will swallow you up. That's one of the quotes out of that thing, and guess what? He thought it was only 1 million. Well, it's been over 3 million. In fact, it's well over 3 million now. It's in the tens of millions, because I think at this point there are something like 50 million Muslims all throughout Europe. And they are literally now seeping into every aspect of European culture and language and ethos, and they are literally displacing it. And that's what's going on. So, from my perspective, watching this happen, when you have all these people that don't have any skills to work, I mean, obviously somebody that comes from Somalia does not have the ability to fix a car like a German engineer at BMW or Mercedes or wherever. And so that person is just simply on the streets eating and or sleeping, and there are tents all over of France now, and all these cities are being taken over. And so if there's no... If it isn't stopped, and in fact, even the Dalai Lama said all these immigrants should be returned to their own countries to fix their own countries instead of just simply coming to Europe, I see either tremendous racial and sociological conflict that will end in civil war, or if the Europeans don't have the guts to stand up to the whole thing, then you'll just see this quagmire of multiculturalism and diversity simply drag them down into the dregs of society, and that everybody gets to be poor and miserable and illiterate, and at some point there's no way to feed or house all of these indigent individuals from Africa and certainly from the Middle East, and you're going to just see third world conditions proliferate. And that's already very true in much of what's going on in Paris, and certainly in England, and Denmark, and Brussels, and Norway, and Sweden. And of course, you now know that Sweden is the rape capital of Europe, because it has so many of these Muslims, and they are literally, that's what they do. They just rape women, because that women only stand as, I forget, it's either one quarter or one half the value of a man, and the misogyny in the Muslim religion is 100%. And so when you see all this mixing and this sociological chaos, then it just degrades in entire societies.
Are the yellow vests in France, are they protesting the immigration?
Well, they, that's what you would, you would hear that they were protesting the climate change tax on all the fuels, but my brother's over there, so I know exactly what's going on, and what they're really protesting is that their country is being overrun by immigration,
right?
And you're going to see more of them out, and they're gathering more and more strength. I don't think Macron, who is, you know, the president of France at this point, I don't think he's going to last, and I think very much at some point Le Pen, the Marine Le Pen, is going to get in, and she's going to start deporting everybody illegally, and then she's going to start deporting anybody that does, that crosses any line that's not French, and she's a hardliner, and there's more people, you know, gathering and gaining. Kurtz from Austria, he's a young guy, and he has said, we're not tolerating any Muslim immigration over here because we're not going to have our country overloaded. Poland will not tolerate any Muslims into Poland right now, and Hungary is literally doing the same thing. So you're, and even Italy was, I think his name is Salvini or Salvi, he's saying the same thing. So there are a few people standing up, and there's going to be more and more Europeans stand behind them, and at some point, I think the Germans are going to break away from Merkel, and literally tell her to go, you know, go fly a kite and go ride a cow. Because she's done everything to destroy her own country by taking in excess of 2 million North Africans and Middle Easterners now in the last 3 years, and it's been a nightmare. And this book is showing me that. It's just incredible what this book is telling me. In fact, I get a lot of letters from all over the globe, and I got one from a Great Britain, and he said, and the faster and greater the dilution of citizenship due to immigration and multiculturalism, the less likely it will be to find anyone with enough courage to speak up until finally the real truth of this terrible mistake will be lost forever, unquote. And this was part three of my my book report, essentially, on the strange death of Europe, immigration, identity, and Islam. And in this one, the part three, where I wrote The Strange Death of Europe, Multiculturalism and Diversity Proved Destructive. Anyway, he wrote this back to me. And then I had another letter from an Australian who said pretty much the same words. And so it's going to be a horse race, depending on how many people in Europe say, hey, we're not going to survive this. We've got to start stopping it. We've got to cut it off. And, you know, Geert Wilders from Holland, he wants to throw all the Muslims out of Holland because they are literally taking over Holland. And certainly Macron should get tossed out, and Le Pen could get in. I don't know if there's any champion in the United Kingdom. It seems like the British have just cowered behind all this immigration. And they have voted in Brexit, which was the reason for Brexit and voting to get out of the European Union, is because the Brussels, you know, warlords, if you will, of the European Union are shoving all these immigrants down all these countries' throats and, of course, completely destroying those countries in the process. And that's why England finally said, enough of this. We want to be able to stop this mass immigration that's being forced on us by the European Union.
You know, these yellow vests, the yellow vest movement in France, from what I read, they're saying it's about economic justice, but it's really probably more about immigration, right?
And my brother Rex is telling me that it's baseline, the French are desperate to save their society.
Right.
Because there's 55 million French, but there's 5 million Muslims, and these Muslims are changing the very orientation of all of France. You now have honor killings that are prolific across France. You've got female genital mutilation, which is prolific across France. You've got the no-go zones, which are something over 100 of them, where no cops can go, no firefighters can go. They're simply Muslim slums. And in those Muslim slums, Sharia law is manifested. Women have no rights. Gays don't stand a chance to stand up, period. You've got all of the consequences that are Sharia law. And that's now literally de facto Sharia law has taken over all those arenas, because Muslims don't leave their cultures. They don't leave any of that. They literally live by the mandates of the Quran. And again, the prime directive of the Quran is to convert or kill all non-believers. And that is their major prime directive, and they follow it like a, so many of them are just so rabidly Islamic that they absolutely, you know, Islam is the future of Europe. They have signs out everywhere. They march everywhere, and to hell with the country that's hosting them. And it's pretty nasty. So we're going to see some tremendous conflict over there in Europe.
Now, the Sharia law comes from the Quran, and they have this other book, I think it's called the Hadith?
Hadith, right, that's correct.
Is that like a traditional teachings or something?
Yep, those are the traditional teachings. You have to understand one thing, and I've done over 30-part series on Islam and having read the Quran itself. It is probably one of the most vile, violent books in the world, and it's certainly, you know, the Bible's got its own, you know, storm the gates of Jericho and slaughter all the men, women, and children and all the other stuff that goes with it. But all of that, you know, the Christians no longer go out and slaughter people. They go out and they try to convert them by, they wear two ties and two white shirts, and they proselytize and so forth. But the Muslims, they do it violently. They do it by the sword, and they've been doing it because their prophet was an absolute beast of a man. I mean, illiterate warlord who cut people's heads off if they disagreed with him, cut their hands off if they ever disagreed with him. He raped 9, 10-year-old, 11-year-old girls, which was the norm back then. He literally made everybody subject to his reign of power. He essentially, Muhammad was the Hitler of the sixth century. He was the Hitler, and he was violent, and all of his followers since then are violent. I don't care if you go back to the 1972 Olympics when they just killed all the Jewish players, and you go to 9/11 and you go to hundreds, if not thousands, of Islamic attacks, whether it's Nice, France, or whether it's San Bernardino, or whether it's Orlando, or Fort Lauderdale, or Garland, Texas, or Ohio State, or Mount St. Cloud up in Minnesota. Just last fall, about 200 of those Somalis attacked an entire, show or program. It was a county fair. There's now between 23 and 27 honor killings in the U.S. every year. There's 500,000 cases of female genital mutilation here in the United States. And these are all barbaric acts that are now literally manifesting here in the United States of America. And that's documented. I can give you the documentation if you like.
Now, Muhammad was a warlord, according to our history. But do you think some of that might be a little inaccurate?
No, because, see, there was a lot of warlords, and they're all trying to get their deal going, and they all want to. If you look back at Italy, anybody that's traveled to Italy, you'll see all of, literally dozens and dozens and dozens of cities that were walled cities. They all had walls to protect the king and the queen in that walled city, but also to fend off from attacks from other kings who were trying to get more turf. I mean, Florence was once an entirely walled city, and Rome was a walled city, and Volterra was a walled city, and Colle Valdelsa was a walled city. I've gone through a lot of those walled cities, and so you had all that kind of violence going on. Well, just take the same kind of violence. You know, you've got Troy, you've got the Greeks fighting Troy. I mean, that's all history is battles for turf. The Romans were fantastic at it. They conquered everybody because they were a mechanized army, and they had tremendous ability to build roads. And most of those roads are for war, and they were for those the chariots and the wagons and the logistics and the food to help these armies go off and conquer everybody. Well, the same thing was going on in Saudi Arabia and certainly in Kurdistan and Iraq and Afghanistan. Same thing going on in India and Pakistan. So, yeah, this has just been a norm for the human race all these years.
Now, some of my reading, it seems like Muhammad was an orphan, wasn't he, for a while? And he was raised by maybe his uncle or something?
Yeah, he was. From what I recall, he was an orphan. And, you know, he was a very passionate man, obviously. And he got his disciples behind him, just like Jesus got his 12 disciples behind him. You know, there was a dozen Jesuses out there. You know, if you look at Jesus, or you look at Buddha, or you look at Confucius, or you look at the Dalai Lama, or you down through time, there's always these spiritual savants, if you will. And for some reason, back in those times when everybody was illiterate, and virtually everybody was illiterate, they had a fear of a thunderstorm. They had a fear of a tsunami. They had a fear of lightning. They didn't know what an earthquake was. They thought the gods needed somebody to be sacrificed. So the Aztecs and the Incas and everybody else, they're sacrificing virgins and, you know, making these gods happy. Well, that kind of illiteracy breeds all of these religions that are fearful of the unknown. And that's why you have all of this stuff essentially all built on myth and magic, or some savant that somehow caught their imagination through his oratory or through his whatever, and that's where all these religions came from.
It's very strange to me that Islam has the tremendous influence that it does today. Don't we have like 1.5, is it?
Billion. 1.5 billion Muslims, yeah.
In the U.S.?
Fastest growing religion. Oh, no, and around the world. 1.5 billion. We only have about 3.5 million here in the United States.
Okay.
We've imported. Okay. Most of them are all foreign born.
Seems like a lot of people, but in a way, it doesn't seem like that many that they would have.
Well, compared to our entire society of 330 million, but as they continue to chain migrate, and they continue to have, you know, they've got four wives, and it's against the law over here, so they just call them part of the family. But all these men over here have their four wives, one wife, and then they have three other women as part of the family. They're impregnating as many as they can so they can have as many as they can. And notice they're all on welfare here in the United States. We're going to see more and more impact. You've got the two Muslim women in the House of Representatives. Soon you'll see a governor's going to hit it. I think probably the first Muslim governor will be from Michigan. And then you're going to see some get into the Senate, and then you're going to see more get into the power positions in the different houses and the governorships of states. These Muslims, they got one thing: convert or kill all non-believers, and that's what they're out for. That's their prime directive, and we are going to be in their crosshairs from now on out.
It seems to me that Islam is from an earlier time. You know, I think, for example, Christianity had its Crusades period when we were still primitive, but it seems like Islam is still in that stage.
Yeah, it is. In fact, many of top Islamic writers say that Islam cannot become modernized because it's like a virus. Once you are affected by the Quran and you start to be a true believer, and you have no other understanding, you have no more enlightenment. You know, the only reason that all of Europe is not all Muslim is because of Charles Martel back in 722. He actually beat down all of the Muslim hordes coming across the Mediterranean, because they actually had burned their ships on the shores and said, we're going to win or we're going to die. And so Charles Martel, well, I'll make sure you're dead. And he completely killed them off and killed everybody. And that's the only thing that saved Europe for Christianity at that point in time in 722.
It seems like we're moving towards a civil war in the United States, and if I had to guess, I would guess that maybe California is going to break off first. What do you think?
I think California is probably going to fracture. I think there's even right now there's thoughts of it splitting it into two or three different separate states. Mm-hmm. But there's no question in my mind that it's going to become Mexican. I mean, Southern California will become Mexican. And if you don't speak Spanish, well, even if you speak Spanish, white people are going to be streaming out of Southern California. And what's going to happen is because Mexicans do not have a lot of the skills that are needed to carry on a first world society, you're going to see a tremendous amount of breakdown going on there in California, and so that it will degrade down to the same kind of consequences that are now realized in Mexico.
Hmm. So are you saying that you'll think that California will maybe split into two states?
Yeah, it's very possible. There's people talking about it already, mandating that they want to see Northern California and Southern California. I think I've read of several places where they want to actually break it into three different places, three different states. I'm quite serious.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. That seems crazy.
Yeah. Well, the thing is about history, you think everything is permanent.
Yeah,
but
we do.
Again,
we do, don't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, we do. And we thought we had it all together here in the United States. But back in 1965, with that Immigration Reform Act, that was the beginning of the fall of the United States of America.
In 65?
Because we no longer... 65, the Immigration Reform Act of 1965.
Wow.
Because back then we were 90% white. We were 7% black, 3% Spanish. And by 2042, we'll be 51% Spanish. We'll be Latino, Hispanic, Mexican... ethnic group will be the new majority by 2042. You can look that up on pewresearch.org, pewresearch.org. And those are the projections, because Mexicans, Latino Hispanics are literally crossing over the border by the thousands. In fact, it was just on NPR today that in the last 4 months, 200,000 illegals had crossed the borders, the southern borders, in the last 4 months.
Now, 200,000?
200,000. That was an NPR today. I just heard it when I was coming home.
Oh my goodness!
From work.
That's
Oh yeah, 1,500 a night is the minimum. 1,500 a night are coming across. And again, Mark, these people are coming from overpopulated consequences. In fact, I just got a new projection that some state, it was a state in Africa, is going to jump from 75 million to well over 150 million. By 2050, that's in Africa. I'm going to look it up while we're talking here, but I'll tell you what, you sit here and you go, what? But that's what's going on. I mean, the world is populating again. Every listener listening to this, we are adding, humans are adding 83 million more people every single year to the planet, net gain. I can't tell you how terrible that is.
Gosh.
For all of us.
And the destruction of nature. I mean, that's the main thing.
Oh, yeah, exactly. It's absolutely incredible. Okay, here it is right here. Here's the piece. Yep, I've got it right here. Okay, and I just checked up on the KKK. There is question whether or not it was created by the Democrats, so I will not go on record saying that it was.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, it's saying right here that in Africa... The numbers. There's 170 million. I can't find it, but it's. I'll have to reread this thing just to get that figure down. But it's unbelievable. I mean, places like Somalia, they're going to double in population themselves. Somalia. Everybody think we're helping Somalia by bringing them all over here and stick them in Minneapolis. Sorry, they ain't going to do anything, because they're going to jump their population twice the size. I think, and I shared this to you, over in Bangladesh, and we're bringing in Bangladesh citizens by the tens of thousands. Mm-hmm. Bangladesh has 161 million, look it up,
mm-hmm.
161 million people in Bangladesh right now today, and by 2050, which is only 31 years from now, they will have 201 million. So that's another 40 million people. I know this stuff, you just sit and you go, what? Yeah, here's by Don Collins. Much has been written by many writers far more effectively than me about the aptly named population explosion, which has taken Earth's human numbers from 2 billion when I was born in 1931 to nearly 8 billion today. And every day, another 230,000 humans are added to that number every day. So another million every 4 days, 83 million. Oh, here it is. Recently at a luncheon in NYC with James Saylor, who is Vice President and Executive Director of Population Council Center for Biomedical Research, Jim stressed the fact that Nigeria, the most populated nation in Africa, with a present population of 175 million, is likely to double that number to 350 million before 2050. Many other countries have a similar possibility. I want you to breathe that in, every person listening to this, because I'm bringing you, these are absolutely based on UN projections with current birth rates that are not stopping, because again, these people are all illiterate, so the only thing that they do once they have they hit 13 or 14 is to procreate. The most populated nation in Africa, Nigeria, with a present population of 175 million people, is likely to double that number within several decades. There it is.
Isn't something like 6 out of 8 children that are born in Africa die of starvation or related diseases?
And that's right. Yeah, 6 out of 8. But the two that survive times 1.1 billion, you can understand that they just keep multiplying at an extraordinary rate of speed. Oh, and again, most of what that 83 million net gain every year, new babies, they're coming out of Africa and they're coming out of India.
It's the third world nations that seem to be running.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Mexico is going to go from 134 million right now to well over 145 million before the mid-century.
If you were president, Frosty, how would you address this problem?
Well, you know, I really have called for, and a lot of my columns that I've been writing for 20 years, we need a national conference here in the United States of the top senators, the top House members, the governors, and the top religious leaders, and the top environmentalists. And we need to have a giant a conference on what is the carrying capacity of the United States. What is the optimal population for the United States to thrive not only now but 100 years from now? And then we got to figure out what we're going to do when oil runs out here within the next 30 to 40, 50 years at the most. Oil's not going to make it much longer. And we need to say what kind of a civilization do we want to hand our kids? And then from that, and we start making these really, you know, big, you know, massive recycling, 25-cent deposit return laws on everything plastic, everything metal, everything glass. We got to reduce consumption dramatically. We've got to really reduce the carbon footprint as fast as possible by alternative energy or any kind of anything energy. And we have literally got to literally mandate stabilized population. In other words, we already have chosen that since 1965. Because women have only been having 2 children, so we have to stop all immigration into this country and help those people in their own countries. But then once we start doing that and we get this conference every year and we get more solutions by the top brains and the top creative people in this country, whether it's in energy, whether it's resources, whether it's water, all of the different factors that we need, we then need to have an international conference on population worldwide with world leaders in the religion, world leaders of their countries, world leaders in the environment. Because if we keep doing what we're doing, we are, I think I've said this before, we are absolutely guaranteed to collapse this civilization here in this century. In this century, not 100 years from now, we could collapse this entire country, this civilization, within 50 years or less. In fact, it's going to be less.
Yeah, I would say less.
Oh, much less, more than likely. We're you and I are going to be around. I'm 72. I'm going to be around for 10, 15 more years because I'm pretty healthy.
Mm-hmm.
I'll bet if you and I are still speaking on this radio show 10 years from now, there will be 35 million more Americans in this country. It's going to be one hell of a mess just trying to water them and feed them and all that goes with sustaining them with the fact that we're running out of non-renewable resources right now. We're running out of water right now. We're running out of gasoline right now. And we're certainly running out of an equitable and balanced environment right now. Add another 35 million, and then within 10 more years, we will have added another billion to the planet, another billion human beings who are doing all their destruction across the globe, especially in Africa, especially in India, especially in China, especially in Mexico, especially in Sao Paulo, Brazil, Indochina. Yeah, we're in trouble. There's no question we're in such big trouble that you and I are still talking on this show here in 10 years. It's going to be one hell of a mess. And at some point, there's no way to solve it. At some point, there will be no way to solve it.
Is your new book available now?
No, my book won't come out until April, and that book is America's Overpopulation Predicament, Blindsiding Future Generations.
Well, I'm sure that's going to be a great book. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, you know, you've been getting some of these chapters, so you must be sobered at these chapters that you've been getting. I mean, are you excited that you're getting these chapters? I mean, these chapters should just sit there, and you must be going, holy crap, reading those chapters.
You know, I am so stunned by everything that is happening in the world. It's it's just kind of overwhelming. I just, like, the day you said we burn 95 million barrels of oil per day. I mean, that's crazy.
And you found out I was wrong, that it was 99. Yeah.
Well, I think Stephen told me the music has started, Frosty. Thanks for coming on again, okay, man. It's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, Mark. Thank you. I hope that we're creating one heck of a discussion across this country so that we can move toward conferences and solutions to save our country, our civilization, for our children.
Well, let's talk about that next time.
Okay, sounds good.
Bye-bye.